Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are three of my dear friends and co-hosts, and hopefully four here pretty quick. But we have right now Pamela Chaddock, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning, wherever you are, and good day. And happy Diwali.
Yes,
happy
yes,
Diwali.
I was telling these guys before we went on the show that it's a very popular Indian holiday, Hindu festival of lights. It's the triumph of light over darkness, and triumph of good over evil. Isn't that great? I mean, that's and something
knowledge
else.
Over ignorance.
Yeah, knowledge over ignorance. Wow. And so, yeah. You know, it's my son-in-law is from southern India, and it's his favorite holiday of all, and they love to set off fireworks and light up the night, and they feast, and they have wonderful food. It's just really a big deal, and it's, you know, similar to what Christmas is like for a lot of us. So, yeah, Diwali. D-I-W-A-L-I, Diwali.
Yeah.
Check it out. I got to send him something special today over in text or something, some well wish. It's a special holiday for them.
So, well, and it's also Veterans Day today, isn't it?
Yes,
also known as Armistice Day or Remembrance Day north of the border. Yeah.
11-11, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 11-11. Someone said earlier, I saw on television earlier today, on the 11th month of the 11th day at the 11th hour, World War One. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So thank you for your service, veterans. Oh, my
thank
gosh.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Jesus said, for no greater love has a man that he would, than that he would be willing to lay down his life. And, you know, those people who serve us at that level aren't only willing to lay down their life for their friends, they're willing to lay down their life for total strangers so that we all might have a better life. And that is about as noble as it gets. as the Master said, for no greater love than that.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for reminding me of that, Andre. It is Veterans Day.
Mm-hmm.
Yay. Good day to start a new paper on our beloved Eternal Son. I sure enjoyed studying paper 6 with you guys. And the Eternal Son. And now we're off to paper 7, which is the relation, or not the, but relation of the Eternal Son to the universe. So
hey, I just realized why the three persons of the Trinity are eternal. I just realized.
Really?
Cause,
yeah.
Because if they weren't eternal, we'd have to be, you know, figuring out when their birthday was. Now we don't have to figure out when their birthday is. And we can celebrate all the time.
It's one long celebration.
Yeah.
One long celebration of our eternal centers, the first three sources and centers. Oh,
yeah.
And Marvin is with us now. We'll put Marvin on. Hi,
yeah.
Marvin.
Good to have you, Marvin.
Hi, folks.
Hi, Marvin.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Happy Diwali and happy Veterans Day.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to what you all were sharing, and the thought that occurred to me is, you know, there will come a time when, in some far distant future date, when the whole idea of people having to serve and give up their lives in military combat will be looked at as just the most bizarre and barbaric societal situation, you know. I mean, we understand the nobility of it, and it is truly noble. But the idea that people have to kill each other in order to reach resolution on issues is such a barbaric concept. And yet for us, it's normalized, you know, and even made heroic. And it is heroic. I don't mean to diminish that. I'm simply saying the societal circumstances that make that a heroic deed and noble paradoxical. It's so paradoxical that if, you know, it would be heroic for me to take a gun and shoot another human being and deprive them of life on this world, you know, under whatever circumstances.
I know.
Yes, it's such a paradoxical situation.
Yeah. There's a great quote about
is.
That, Marvin, and since you brought it up and since it's timely, I'd just love to read that, because right now, and I'm sure you guys are too, I'm grappling with this world situation that just seems to be dragging us into war, and it's deeply troublesome to me, because the rules seem to have changed, and there's a lot of great quotes in the Arantia book about war, and one of the things that I think is shocking is that it says, no, it has its place, and it does have some advantages to it in advancing civilization, but, and then the but is covered on this quote on paper 70, section 2, paragraph 9. It says, war has had a certain evolutionary and selective value, but like slavery, it must sometime be abandoned as civilization slowly advances. Olden wars promoted travel and cultural intercourse. These ends are now better served by modern methods of transport and communication. Olden wars strengthened nations, but modern struggles disrupt civilized cultures. Ancient warfare resulted in the decimation of inferior peoples. The net result of modern conflict is the selective destruction of the best human stocks. Early wars promoted organization and efficiency, but these have now become the aims of modern industry. During past ages, war was a social ferment which pushed civilization forward. This result is now better attained by ambition and invention. Ancient warfare supported the concept of a god of battles, but modern man has been told that God is love. War has served many valuable purposes in the past. It has been an indispensable scaffolding in the building of civilization, but it is rapidly becoming culturally bankrupt, incapable of producing dividends of social gain in any way commensurate with the terrible losses attendant upon its invocation. That's pretty powerful statements, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then there are the other passages in the text that talk about, you know, these fratricidal battles becoming more and more intense until they could become racially suicidal.
Right.
You know, when we're talking world war anymore, we're talking about the threat of nuclear annihilation, which is a phenomenon this world has never experienced, nothing on a global scale, just enough to scare the bejeebers out of us. But you know, I mean, they talk about consequence, you know, we don't even have a clue how horrendous and vast that consequence could be.
Yeah, the very idea that we'd even flirt with these options is just terrifying to peace lovers like us, I know. And, you know, it was shocking for me because I've never thought of war as having any value whatsoever, being from the generation I'm from. But then when I read the Urantia book, it was like, oh, okay. I think that's one of the most beautiful things about the Revelation is it gives you a perspective.
Yeah.
Such a top-down perspective, you know?
Yes.
Well, that, you know, if you guys don't mind, I was reading the news this morning, and you guys know a little bit about my background, and also this last week we had a gathering of folks from our Interfaith Council, and these are people who have known each other for 20 years and worked together closely, and there are Muslims and Jews among them, and so we had a circle of trust with. I don't want to get too identifying because it was confidential, but there are rabbis who head large congregations, and there's someone who heads up the local Anti-Defamation League on the Jewish end of the spectrum. And we have a Palestinian, one of our dear friends is a Palestinian woman who has family members who have been killed in Gaza, and other Muslim leaders of mosques. And we had a gathering. And the torture, the value torture that people are going through in this current situation, the torques of conscience, you know, because you have a situation where so many innocent civilians are being killed, which is inevitable in war. And you know, there's no sense of who is right and wrong. There are people at the extremes who feel, yes, our side is right, the other side is entirely wrong. But there's violations of value norms being perpetrated across the board on both sides. And so people are torn. You know, American Jews and Muslims being faced with dramatically upstepped levels of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism on both sides.
Yeah.
Because these situations bring out the worst in the corners of human society, and so you have xenophobic reactions on all fronts, and so our culture is dealing. We're in the midst of a very dangerous situation that could lead to global escalation. You know, so it's a precarious period of time, and. Yeah, so it's just it's pretty intense on your rancher these days.
You know, and just one more quote on this topic because it's been coming to me many, many times over the last few weeks, and that's from Rodin of Alexandria, and it's paper 160, section 3, paragraph 4. So it's in the Jesus Papers. Rodin tells the apostles that he was chatting with. My philosophy tells me that there are times when I must fight, if need be, for the defense of my concept of righteousness. but I doubt not that the master, with a more mature type of personality, would easily and gracefully gain an equal victory by his superior and winsome technique of tact and tolerance. All too often, when we battle for the right, it turns out that both the victor and the vanquished have sustained defeat. I heard the master say only yesterday that a wise man, when seeking entrance through the locked door, would not destroy the door, but rather would seek for the key wherewith to unlock it. Too often we engage in a fight merely to convince ourselves that we are not afraid. That is so powerful, too.
Well,
that
that's part of what's...
The victor
yeah,
and the vanquished both sustaining defeat is what, you know, to me
right.
it seems like the modern scenario for war. There's just no way that anybody wins in that deal. It would just be too horrific and ugly, and
well,
which
you know,
we're seeing.
Yeah, part of what's so horrible about that current war is the different parties, and there are really three, two combatants and one here in this country that's alive and well, are being fueled by religious ideologies. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, on the Jewish end, it's like the right, you know, to reoccupy a land that was taken from us. On the Muslim end, it's, you know, it's the right for us to have a homeland, and driven by, you know, religious zealotry as well at the extremes in other countries. And then in this country, it's really interesting. I mean, you've got a strong fundamentalist Christian point of view that basically has this is the fulfillment of the end times biblically. And so we must support Israel to the death, and if it brings world conflagration, well, then that's part of prophecy. And that's alive and well in our scene as well.
Yeah.
So in a very curious way, you have religious ideologies driving this particular battle. So it's such a paradoxical situation.
Right. Well, and I know that there's strong opinions among us even and among our listeners, and so I won't, you know, we probably shouldn't keep going with this conversation except to say that we pray for peace. Well, I know all of us
absolutely.
Do, and I know that none of us want to see anybody, especially not innocent children and, you know, families and mothers and fathers who just are working hard and playing by the rules, you know, get caught up.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just keep praying every day for peace on this world and for the Father's will to be done, our Father, our loving, beloved, righteous Father. That all good things will come to this world, and I know they will because that was Jesus' promise, and I'm going to hold on to that. You know.
Well, the passage you read. Yeah, just to say the passage you read, Paula, is right on target because Jesus' attitude was that of pragmatic solution finding and peace prevailing, you know, we have a shortage of that in these situations.
Mm-hmm. Here's a pertinent comment, I think, from Paper 99, where they talk about, they're talking about the church, but I think this also applies to probably any religionist. So if we think of ourselves, of course, as religion.
Yeah.
Anyway, it says 99.25, just in the middle of the paragraph, it says, speaking of the church, but again, you know, anyone who's spiritually inclined, they say its only proper attitude consists in the teaching of nonviolence, the doctrine of peaceful evolution in the place of violent revolution, peace on earth and goodwill among all men.
Beautiful, Chuck.
But anyway, that's the attitude of nonviolence, you know, advocating for nonviolence, you know, always
yeah.
in the face of these conflicts. I mean, other people can argue the merits of the conflict and maybe jump in on one side or the other. But those who are trying to, you know, coming from a higher spiritual perspective, our only proper attitude is to advocate for nonviolence. So, I mean, there are nonviolent solutions to all problems if people are just willing to work on it and figure it out.
I think love is what's missing in the equation.
Yeah, ironically. There you go.
If we truly loved each other, then of course we would seek nonviolent solutions to our problems. What's missing is love. So, and Jesus said, you know, devote your lives to proving that it's the greatest thing in the world. Love. The greatest power on earth and in heaven. Love. It's what holds us all together. It's what makes life worth living. And it's also what hurts so bad when you see stuff like this happening. So,
well, that's, you know, that's one of the problems with war, is it, especially in the modern era where we can do things other ways. We just put our time to figuring it out. But in paper 70, near where you were reading, Paula, they comment that war causes society to be temporarily thrown back into savagery. It's such a kind of, whoa, the terrible price paid for these certain war advantages was that society was temporarily thrown back into savagery. Civilized reason had to abdicate. War
is
strong medicine, very costly and most dangerous. While often curative of certain social disorders, it sometimes kills the patient.
The patient
destroys society.
That's an even more powerful quote than the one I read. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And this one line out of that paragraph you read really struck me too. So I say, olden wars strengthened nations, but modern struggles disrupt civilized culture.
Mm.
So that's, you know, it's what happens. you're used to being able to just travel somewhere and, you know, see the sights.
Right.
You know, I don't know. But when nations are caught up in war, then everybody's, you gotta do that. You know, I mean, the disruption to the norms of everyday life that we get used to is very disturbing, obviously. But it's disturbing because people are dying seemingly unnecessarily.
Yeah.
Just shake your head and kind of horror.
Well, you know, what it does is it unleashes the animalistic tendencies in human nature, and it crowds out the much more sober and balanced spiritual perspectives that come from connection with God. Those get shoved aside.
Savagery.
Yeah, in the passions of reaction and cross reaction. So, you know, we're still in such a semi primitive state. We're still in the adolescence of humanity, where we lose our governing center, you know, our spiritual governing center.
Maybe, Marvin, that's the brink we're teetering on. You know, your comment just made me think of that. Yeah. We're teetering on that brink, the brink of savagery on one side, you know, sliding back into darkness and savagery, or sliding forward into light and life. You know, one side is darkness and death, the other side is light and life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're teetering on that brink of one of our most enthralling epics. If only we can just, you know, it gives you the sense that you could just nudge it one way or the other. When I think of something teetering on the brink, I think of, well, it could be nudged one way or the other. And now you see it kind of being nudged towards darkness, right? We want to keep that momentum so that we start gliding into, you know, or at least moving into light and life in that direction.
Well, Paula, you mentioned love, the power of love. I mean, that is the biggest gap we have to cross. And look what happened to Jesus. You know, the prophet of love. So, and if somebody like him gets crucified for love, we have a long way to go. even after 2,000 years of grappling with what love, what, you know, what the advantages of love are. we've got a lot of education that has to take place.
Yeah.
Love and
compassion. It's one thing to say it.
Compassion.
It's one thing to say it.
Yeah.
Another thing to make it a real living reality.
Yeah.
You know, and what occurs to me when you said that, Pam, is love is often considered a weakness.
Exactly.
And, and according to Jesus, no. It's our strength. And so if we honored that in each other, if we honored not only the fact that we love, but the fact that everyone else loves, and they're all, you know, we all love those special people in our lives. We don't want to see that, you know, especially from a woman's point of view, when you suffer to bring life into this world, and then you work so hard to nurture it every day. So your whole reason for living, and I'm sure fathers feel this way too, you know, is to nurture that life and make sure that it thrives in this world.
Yes.
Only to see it decimated? My gosh. What could be cooler than that? I can't think of anything more cruel than that. And we just have to stop doing that to each other. Somehow, some way.
Let's find nonviolent solutions.
Right.
That's our assignment.
And the book tells us. It gives us clues, you know, about travel, about trade, about getting to know our fellows, you know, getting familiar with their literature, their culture. Just get to know the world. Get to know them. And then you will fall in love with them. And once you fall in love with them, it becomes that much harder, you know, which is why I so applaud Interfaith, Marvin. Thank you for your work in Interfaith. It's important. Because you learn to fall in love with your fellow man. You travel. I'm going to India in December. I'm so excited about that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, we're going to go celebrate May and Shankar in Shankar's hometown. It'll be really special.
Oh, that's great.
And every time I go to another place in the world, I go with an attitude of an open heart, and I end up falling in love with them. I fall in love with their culture. I fall in love with every little thing they do. You know, it's endearing to me because when you go there, you're immersed in what they do every day. And you see, they're just like us. There's no real, you know, I mean, they love each other. That's the most important takeaway.
Where are you going? His hometown?
Chennai and then Trichy. Shankar's from Trichy.
Which state that's in?
Southern India.
Okay.
Gosh. Yeah.
Anyway, well, Vipin's from Kerala. Kerala.
Oh, Kerala, right.
It's kind of on the southwestern coast and from the city of Trichy. So, you know, I spent some time there when they had their Hindu wedding, Angie Vipin. And Trichy, I mean, you walk around there, and on one corner you'll see it. Christian cathedral. On the next corner, you'll see a mosque. And then down the street, there'll be a Hindu temple or multiple Hindu temples. And at the same time, they have like a communist thing going on there too. They sort of trade off their governing responsibilities between the Christians and the communists, if you can believe that. Anyway, so those four polarities are really, they're not normal, you know, you don't normally think of them just easily getting along, right? But they're all there,
right.
You know, and people do get along, you know, whether they're Hindu or Christian or Jewish or Islam.
The book tellers say they are very religiously tolerant for the most part, I think, somewhere, if I recall.
Well, that was the impression I got, and for sure, I don't know if it's that way everywhere, but it's kind of a live and let live attitude. And some of that, I think, comes down from Hinduism through Krishna, their concept of Krishna, because that's probably the dominant, you know, influence there. And, you know, Krishna is a sort of almost Jesus-like character in his nature. and I've noticed that mm-hmm. being there, the people who follow Krishna, I don't, maybe you'll experience this too, but they're just lovely people. I mean, your book talks about how you become like what you worship, right?
Right.
And people that worship Hindu or, I mean, worship Krishna, put it in those terms, take on his characteristics, which are lovely, you know, all the
mm-hmm.
stories about Krishna, the way they understand who he was and what he is and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So Vipin's family is very into Krishna, for example. So,
oh.
But I think that's probably common in for sure. So it's very safe there. Even though you see poverty, I mean, you can walk the streets at night. Women walk by themselves at night, you know, no problem. Very safe to be there.
Wow.
And I think that's part of the influence that brings
well,
that about.
That's,
I mean, not that they don't have problems. They got a lot of other problems.
Well, sure.
But you know,
random
I think
violence isn't one of them.
I think it's part of the history of every substantial sized religious group. I mean, the history of the relationship between Hindus and Muslims in India is there are plenty of instances of rampaging killing
each absolutely.
Other. So it's it's the same situation. It's the
yeah.
same situation in Judaism, in Hinduism, in Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
In Islam, in Christianity, in every major religious group. They're really, the way I've come to understand it, is there are really largely two groups of people. People who are, and we're putting aside for the moment the spiritual impetus, which is, of course, crucial. But there are two groups of people. There are people who are ideologues who are basically saying, it's my way is the right way, and every other way must yield to it. And there are
mm-hmm.
people who, and that, and they exist in every religious tradition.
Yes,
and
true.
History is full of, and then there are pragmatists and solution finders, people who are really motivated by the deeper spiritual motivations of their traditions that say, we must reach across the gap of each other's traditions and find peace and love and respect for each other. And we must find solutions. And it's not my way is the right way. It's the only way that's the right way is the way that we can walk together as humanity,
right.
You know, as one spiritual family. And so wherever you see these struggles, you see these two groups of people, pragmatists who are seeking solutions and are spiritually motivated, and those who basically say, my way is the right way, and I will kill anyone that stands in my path. So you see that historical battle unfolding many, many times.
Hmm.
Good point. Well,
how about that amazing son?
Yeah.
That original son.
I hear he's
ever
eternal,
concerned with the execution of the spiritual aspects of the Father's eternal purpose. I don't know where I read that, but... You
yeah,
know,
it's just trippingly off, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about that son? Our eldest of eldest brothers in the universe of universes.
Our eldest brother.
What would he
first,
want?
Yeah.
Our first
original
brother.
Original brother.
Or what would she want? Right. Our mother's son. Right.
Mother's son, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which pronoun are we going to use?
Yeah, right.
Right.
All of them.
Right, right.
I love what Errol Strider said about that, by the way. He used to call God the hermit, which is her, him, it.
Oh,
and he said
I love
it's better than the other option, which is he, she, it.
Oh, there you go.
Errol is ever finding a joke in eternity.
Oh,
he'll be a reversion director at some point, I'm sure.
Oh, he
no,
is.
No,
yeah, no doubt.
Question.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Well, it really is interesting that they describe the eternal son, the second person of deity, as the eternal mother son. I mean, I
yes.
think it's really
yeah.
it's quite significant. Because
yes.
at one and the same time, the son is the creature that is created by the originating creator, the father, and is co-creator with that father of that third person. And so the mother part of the son is both. The son is both the created being and the co-creator. And
right.
In a certain sense, we being the sons of God are both. We are both created beings, and we partake in creation when we beget children. And so, you know, we're all of us, we partake of that mother-son combination in a certain sense.
That's interesting, Lord, and that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We can relate, you know, to our our beloved eternal son. Shall we start this paper?
let's find out more about him.
Yeah, keep going with this amazing.
Who do you want to read
reality,
this, Paula?
Well, there's the first part, and there's several paragraphs. So, Andre, do you want to take the preamble, and then we'll go on to spirit gravity from there?
That sounds good. Relation of the Eternal Son to the Universe. The original Son is ever concerned with the execution of the spiritual aspects of the Father's eternal purpose as it progressively unfolds in the phenomena of the evolving universes with their manifold groups of living beings. We do not fully comprehend this eternal plan, but the Paradise Son undoubtedly does. The Son is like the Father in that he seeks to bestow everything possible of himself upon his coordinate sons and upon their subordinate sons. And the Son shares the Father's self-distributive nature in the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the Infinite Spirit, their conjoint executive. As the upholder of spirit realities, the second source and center is the eternal counterpoise of the Isle of Paradise, which so magnificently upholds all things material. Thus is the first source and center forever revealed in the material beauty of the exquisite patterns of the central aisle and in the spiritual values of the supernal personality of the Eternal Son. The Eternal Son is the actual upholder of the vast creation of spirit realities and spiritual beings. The spirit world is the habit, the personal conduct of the Son, and the impersonal realities of spirit nature are always responsive to the will and purpose of the perfect personality of the Absolute Son. The Son is not, however, personally responsible for the conduct of all spirit personalities. The will of the personal creature is relatively free and hence determines the actions of such volitional beings. Therefore, the free will spirit world is not always truly representative of the character of the Eternal Son, even as nature on Urantia is not truly revelatory of the perfection and immutability of paradise and deity. But no matter what may characterize the free will action of man or angel, the Son's eternal grasp of the universal gravity control of all spirit realities continues as absolute.
Free will.
You know, I wanted to say something about this. We were talking about the Son Mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me right here in paragraph 702, and the Son shares the Father's self-distributed nature in the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the Infinite Spirit, who is the Minister Mother.
Mm.
So that's where the tie-in for the mother-ishness comes. Doesn't that seem where that might arise?
Yeah. Well, the son is a son by lineage, but functionally, often more like a mother.
Yes.
So there's lineage and function, and sometimes, you know, the way the pronouns get used in the way those functions are described leads to a situation like this where we're talking about we have a male pronoun for lineage, but you know, he functions like a mother in the creation of the infinite spirit. And no doubt other ways as well. Seem confusing, but there is some logic to it if you think about it.
You know, that's where I think we kind of run right up against our inability to grasp these eternal realities. And we also run up against their difficulty in expressing it in a language that we might possibly begin to understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first family of all creation, father, mother, and child, is so basic. And it really doesn't, and yet from those three great sources and centers comes all of reality. And all of those family relationships.
Yeah,
so I think
master,
our creature minds just
body.
Crave.
Mm-hmm.
We crave to be able to understand it that way, you know.
Sure.
And, they're indulging us in that. But then I often think of Jesus saying, there, you know, in the kingdom, as he was forced to, you know, again, put that terminology on it. There is no male-female free bond, you know.
Right.
None of those things as you understand them exist up there. It's one great family of equality.
Well,
mm-hmm.
we still have male and female as we ascend.
Yeah, tendencies.
We will.
Well, you know, I don't get the sense, Paula, that none of them exist up there. What I get the sense of is they all exist up there in ways that we really can't understand that flow together. So the sun, and this is true in our own nature down here, but I think it's true up there as well. I think the sun is both a created being and has both, in a sense, what we associate with masculine attributes, but also has maternal and feminine attributes wrapped up in the sun's own nature, the mother sun's own nature, that they're both, they're sort of gender fluid in that sense. I think we as humanity share that, in a sense, paradoxical combination. We're all these things flowing through our nature. I mean, we are of the order of the sons. Both men and women are of the order of the sons of God. But you put that together with the fact that the women, women human beings, female human beings, are functionally maternal in their nature while being sons of God, and that male human beings, also being sons of God, get to participate in maternal functions and nurturing and caretaking of children. So, you know, I mean, I think the same combining and intermixing of these qualities that exists on paradise in these beings also exists in the most simple level in our own natures. And the adventure of trying to sense them and tease them out and honor them and really love them, these qualities, is part of our adventure as mortal ascenders, they say.
Yeah, it becomes a balance of viewing the wholeness, the unitiveness versus the diversity, the uniqueness. And we think we have uniqueness now. Hang on to your hat, kids.
Yeah.
I think it's a value agreement on some level, and then the value is we make these differences because we inherently want to put more value on one than the other.
Yes.
And I think Jesus was saying that, and then that's not the case up there.
Right.
All are
right.
valuable. And here's the exact quote. This is from paper 150. 1:3. I won't read the whole paragraph because it is a really big paragraph, but it says, this was a decided shock to even the 12 apostles, notwithstanding they had many times heard the Master say that, quote, in the kingdom of heaven there is neither rich nor poor, free nor bond, male nor female. All are equally the sons and daughters of God. They were literally stunned when he proposed formally to commission these 10 women as religious teachers and even to permit their traveling about with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a shocking individual Jesus was. what a hero of all heroes Jesus was. But
yeah.
I think that is, it's the value that we put on those things, those, you know, we tend to say, well, rich is better than poor, and free is better than bond, and, you know, but no.
Well, there's one of the factors that runs through all this is the idea or the reality even of what the book calls master patterns.
Right.
I've always been intrigued by this sentence from paper 111.45, where they say, only in the higher levels of the superconscious mind, as it impinges upon the spirit realm of human experience, can you find those higher concepts in association with effective master patterns, which will contribute to the building of a better and more enduring civilization. So the idea of pattern realities, you know, like Avonis is a pattern universe in a sense. It demonstrates the pattern of perfection in every way that can be conceived. But even within ourselves, with our adjuster, with whatever, you know, what they're talking about here is, you know, this higher level of the super conscious mind as it impinges upon the spirit realm. I mean, that's, you know, we have that capacity, even if we're not fully conscious of it, I guess. But this idea of finding higher concepts in association with effective master patterns, I mean, that's such a powerful
mm-hmm.
idea, I think,
mm-hmm.
because that can guide so many things, you know, like relationships,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking at this, like we're talking about now, with the
right.
pattern of relationships with the Trinity. I mean, there's a master pattern there. Yeah, it's sort
Absolutely.
Of in simple terms, mother, father, and child. You know, that's
primal.
That's
mm-hmm.
super additive. That's a demonstration of complemental synergy and super additive outcome, you could say. And that's something
mm-hmm.
we all experience too. Every friendship and relationship we have creates super additive outcome, sort of in the same way, or at least along the lines of that same master pattern, even in our own humble
mm-hmm.
circumstances.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. If we allow them to, they do.
Yeah, so becoming aware of the reality of these master patterns is, I think, very helpful. It's not
another
that it
reason.
Predetermines or predetermines behavior, but it creates a sort of a channel or a, you know,
yeah.
a realm mm-hmm. of principle where you can
there
see.
You go.
Oh, okay.
An ideal.
Yeah. An ideal.
Yeah.
Standards, ideals, mm-hmm. principles, all
yeah.
that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Epical revelation.
Epical revelation. Hey. You can find
hey.
One, yeah.
How blessed we are to even have that possibility in our lexicon, right? The idea
yeah.
that there are epical revelations on this world
yeah.
and to have a
oh,
real
boy.
Sense of what they have meant to us and what
mm-hmm.
they've done
yeah,
for us.
But getting that through to some people, it doesn't come easy.
No.
The step into love is a big the step into epical revelation is just as big a step.
Oh,
it's not bigger. It's bigger
yeah.
because you have to drop everything you believed before. Or you have to be willing to explore a new way of looking.
Reevaluate.
And that is a transition time that they say is a difficult time. And it's not just the transition time from believing in God. I mean, that is a major transition.
Mm-hmm.
But the transition to believing in the epical revelations that God provides, it's like not that
right.
many
That's
people want to take that leap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big leap for a lot of people.
It's a big leap. And you know what I think? When I look at this world from a spiritual point of view, and lately I like to watch these videos about people saving dogs. I'm a dog lover, and you know, here they are starving on the side of the road, and some console comes over and tries to win their trust, and it takes a tremendous amount of patience for this poor dog that has been so abused. And dogs are naturally good natured. They're friends to humans, you know. But it takes so much for this poor dog who's been so neglected and abused to finally trust that here's a human that doesn't mean them harm. But when they finally do let go and realize that this human isn't here to harm them, then this human takes them and gets them all that they need to be restored to be a healthy and happy animal again. And I think of humanity in the same way, isn't that right? I mean, I think what you were saying, Pam, about we're just innately distrustful that anybody has our best interest at heart.
Yeah, it must be a scam. It's got to be a scam.
Right. Yeah.
And it's going to take a lot of patience, and thank goodness.
Yeah.
So, but I have a question for you, Andre, about paragraph 3, which really struck. I would like you maybe to, if you can, explain it a little bit. As the upholder of spirit realities, this is what we just read, paragraph 3,
mm-hmm.
from paper 7, section 0. As the upholder of spirit realities, the second source and center is the eternal counterpoise of the Isle of Paradise, which so magnificently upholds all things material. Thus is the first source and center forever revealed in the material beauty of the exquisite patterns of the central aisle and in the spiritual values of the supernal personality of the eternal sun.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
Well, what is the thing that is sparking your interest?
Oh, there's several things, and this whole section was just packed full. If you ask me for a preamble, it was like there's a lot in here, and go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, that the second
Sorry,
source
I interrupted.
Is the eternal counterpoise. That's an interesting word.
Yeah.
Of the Isle of Paradise, which, you know, this idea that the Father, that paradise is the material balance of reality, right?
Yeah.
That, to me, is a very intriguing concept.
Yes, and that had to happen. That had to happen in the sun. And he is the balance of spirit and materiality.
Yeah, when the Father chose to manifest, you know, essentially reality eternally. And, of course, they make a time-space concession to us in relating this story as the I Am had to be assumed to have pre-existent self-will in there, that the I Am chose as a first, quote-unquote, act to essentially divide reality into all of what could be spiritual reality and all of what could be non-spiritual reality. And all non-spiritual reality coalesced as the Isle of Paradise, as the actual of all non-spiritual reality, whereas the sun became the repository or the, you know, that's a crude way to put it, of course, but what is the counterpoise of that by being the absolute of all spiritual reality.
Wow.
And so that's the counterpoise aspect. Paradise is equal to the Son and the Father as an absolute, clearly not as deity, but as an absolute.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Paradise is the absolute of all non-spiritual and what we would regard as material reality, but material is a little too confining to apply to paradise. Matter and energy matter and energy are themselves attenuation of the reality paradise truly is. So, and then they go on with that story and say that in the presence of paradise, the Father and the Son projected that unifying person that was the infinite spirit, the absolute of mind that would resolve the tensions between non-spiritual and spiritual reality. Now, they don't make that kind of story about the three absolutes of potentiality, the deity absolute, the unqualified absolute, and the universal absolute, but you could suppose that in those absolute actuals coming into being, there had to be also coming into being those absolute potentials as well. And in that, the cycle of reality is complete. And then they go back and they remind us, but this was an eternity event. There was no time in the past where this was ever the case. Right.
The plot
thickens. Eternal Son has always existed co-eternally with the Father, as has the Infinite Spirit, as has Paradise, as have the three absolutes. So go figure that out. Have fun with that. We'll have a better idea in a few hundred billion years. We'll get it a little bit better by then.
Well, thank you.
What I wanted to point out along with that, something that really intrigued me here was both just in paragraph two. It's a remarkable statement, and it's been stated in the previous paper, and I'll underscore that, but it's really astounding. It's very similar to this aspect of co-eternality, the idea that there's no inequality between the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. These are three equal persons. Notwithstanding, there is source relationship. Notwithstanding, there is that relationship of even, you could say, deference in some part, you know, of the second source and center and the third source and center to their first source and center Father. Still, that they are all equal. Okay. The Son is like the Father in that he seeks to bestow everything possible of himself upon his coordinate sons and upon their subordinate sons. Now you think about that and you say coordinate sons and subordinate sons. Well, we get subordinate sons, sure. Isn't every creation of the Father and the Son, aren't they the Father and the Son, or the Father or the Son, aren't they subordinate sons? But they use the word coordinate. And coordinate doesn't mean subordinate. It means equal. It means on a plane of equality. And in 615, they make that point, and I put that in the chat previously, and in that they say, Salvington, the headquarters of your local universe, I'm reading the whole paragraph, but it's the last part that pertains, of your local universe, this Son is of record as the second eternal source and center. So that's how we regard the eternal Son, you know, on Salvington. We read that a few weeks ago. The Melchizedek speak of him as the Son of Sons. And we discussed that and what that meant. And that meant Son of Sons, not in the subordinate, but in the superlative sense, right?
Right.
On your world, but not in your system of inhabited spheres, this original Son has been confused with a coordinate creator Son, Michael of Nebadon, who bestowed himself upon the mortal races of Urantia. They are saying, you know, the creator sons are regarded as equal to the eternal Son. Now that's astounding. That's an astounding statement. Of course, they didn't say subordinate sons. They didn't say
no. And they said coordinate.
When you read Yeah, when you read further, you read, well, each creator son, right, is the personification of an absolute thought coordinated with an absolute expression of that thought that come together from the Father and the Son, that then when they unify, create that new creator son. That's an astounding statement. It's the statement of equality there. And yet, you know, there was nothing but deference in Jesus of Nazareth's attitude as he displayed it on in his bestowal on earth to, you know, the universal Father. He had complete, you know, deference in relationship, and yet he is the personification of an absolute idea, something that in the same way that we have potential because of a thought adjuster to, you know, go through and explore all of the supreme and eventually all of the ultimate, and they suppose, will we be able to penetrate, you know, the deity absolute and the absolutes in our progression? Some suspect yes. Some suspect, who knows what they suspect. But, you know, the idea of the Creator Sons as well will have a journey of constantly unfolding some new things. In fact, they indicate that because after the seventh bestowal, there were new potentials that were transcendent of the finite that were opened up by virtue of the Son achieving supreme sovereignty in his universe and to his universe. You know, he really, truly, fully comprehends the supreme and is really the only being in Nebadon who does so to the fullness of the capacity to do so, and therefore is sovereign in that sense. All of that coordinate stuff is interesting. Go ahead.
Can I?
Let Pam share something, and then Marvin, you go.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Pam.
Yeah. What I hear you saying with this, Andre, is that the Creator Sons, the Coordinator Sons, the only way they can get out of eternity is through the creation of their coordinated sons.
In other
words, out into the realm of the supreme and out into our infinitude. And in other words, you know, for instance, the Bible believers think that, you know, Jesus is the second part of Trinity.
Right.
Many do. Although they're not real confident about that because they can't really justify it somehow either. But it's like, I'm really glad we're talking about this, because to share the concept of a creator son with, say, a Christian today, they're going to think he's not good enough. That's not good enough. My God's bigger than that. But this really describes exactly who they are. They are an absolute repercussion of the Father and the Son wanting to make an image of themselves.
That's exactly right.
In other words, to get, they can't come into it the way we can. I mean, the way they can't come into finitude where we are.
Finitude.
Without,
I like that.
Without doing that, without creating that image-based creative
bridge.
So
the bridge between time and eternity.
Yes, and you just described that really, really well, and I appreciate that, Andre, because it sharpens my ability to share, you know, that coordinated reality and how powerful it really is.
And that's what really struck me as well.
Language.
Yeah, that struck me as well, the idea that they are making they're making it clear without being too heavy-handed about it. You know, they're not trying to, you know, dwell on this concept, but they're trying to get us to get the concept.
Right.
And what they're trying to get us to get is that as coordinate suns, and 622 gets into this as well, right? The eternal Son is the eternal Word of God. He is holy like the Father. In fact, the eternal Son is God the Father personally manifest to the universe of universes. So there's another equation, you know, just divested of all of the non-spiritual aspect. And thus it was and is and forever will be true of the eternal Son, and get this, and of all the coordinate creator sons.
There you go.
Coordinate creator sons.
Yep.
They're making that point.
Yeah.
And they're doing it in such a way not to confuse us with a word like equal, but to use the word coordinate in such a way that, you know, together with them, okay, they are equal.
Mm.
And then they underscore it with, he who has seen the Son has seen the Father. How could that be unless the Creator Sons had that nature within them? It's not just like a distilled essence and, okay, you get to see it because you distilled the essence just right. No. No, it's really there absolutely in the Creator Sons. And so you make an excellent point with regard to the idea that no Christian can have a problem with this. Jesus of Nazareth is not being put down. He's actually being elevated up. If only we could understand the concept.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they're not. Yes. That confusion is not wholly unsubstantiated. I mean, you can understand where the confusion comes from. Then that he is actually the second person of deity, but. This is the beauty of Revelation, that it clarifies all of this for us and helps us get to these finer points, which add so much meaning and value. But Marvin, do you remember what you were going to say?
Yeah, well, I've been holding on to a few points. One, I looked for the passage, and this is sort of a somewhat separate topic, but it's related. I looked for the passage and I couldn't find it. Maybe one of you can. But I know it's in the text where they say that the Creator Sons are each created unique, and they vary in their expression of all of what is potential or possible, and that our particular Creator Son, Jesus, the Christ Michael of Nebadon, is more dominated by the maternal and mercy dominated than many other sons. So that's an emphasis in the Creator Son of our local universe that's a little unusual, that in a sense Jesus is more maternal and mercy dominated. So that was one thought, and if we find the passage, we can read it. I know it's there. The other
mercy dominated is the key. That's the word. I think that
there is one passage that I did find. It's just in passing, and it says it's 148:11.
140,
Michael of Nebadon is a mercy dominated son. Compassion is his very nature. But there is another one that indicates that the Creator Sons vary. They're created uniquely. And ours has that quality very prominent. And I thought it was associated with a maternal nature as well. So that was...
Yeah,
that
it's
was
really in
point.
21, Section 1, Origin and Nature of Creator Sons. it's stated clearly enough there, and it's probably restated elsewhere, but... if we look at the second paragraph, each Creator Son is the only begotten and only begettable offspring of the perfect union of the original concepts of the two infinite and eternal and perfect minds of the ever-existent creators of the universe of universes. There never can be another such son, because each Creator Son is the unqualified, finished, and final expression and embodiment of all, of every phase, of every feature, of every possibility, of every divine reality that could, throughout all eternity, ever be found in, expressed by, or evolved from those divine creative potentials which united to bring this Michael Sun into existence. Each creator's Sun is the absolute of the united deity concepts which constitute his divine origin.
Wow.
Is that close enough?
Yeah,
Here's another one.
They leave no wiggle room in that statement.
No.
I gotta say.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead,
they
Chuck.
Didn't leave
and
any comment.
No, and I do want to, I've got a whole other point I want to make, but go ahead, Chuck, if you have another passage.
Well, this adds on to what you're saying, I think. This is in paper 140. They're talking about the different attitudes related to doing the Father's will. And they speak of the social attitude, you know, of Jesus' teaching. And this is just a quick paragraph. They say, the Jewish rabbis had long debated the question, who is my neighbor? Jesus came presenting the idea of active and spontaneous kindness, a love of one's fellow men, so genuine that it expanded the neighborhood. I love that idea, expanded the neighborhood to include the whole world, thereby making all men one's neighbors. But with all this, Jesus was interested only in the individual, not the mass. Jesus was not a sociologist, but he did labor to break down all forms of selfish isolation. He taught pure sympathy and compassion. Michael of Nevadon is a mercy-dominated son. Compassion is his very nature.
Oh, I love that quote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the paragraph that I had found as well. But there's one more, I thought, that it's somewhere in there, where they talk about our Creator Son as being dominated by mercy. And also, this could be just my subjective recollection, but I thought it associated the maternal and motherly aspects of the set of possibilities that our particular Creator Son emphasized in his own nature. So, we'll keep looking. But anyways.
Well, there's a place where they talk about how he partook of the nature of both his mother and his father.
That's a different thing,
but it is related.
Yeah.
Well, they do state that in the very next paragraph in section 1 of paper 21. In section 3, or in paragraph 3, the divine natures of these creator sons are in principle derived equally from the attributes of both paradise parents. All partake of the fullness of the divine nature of the universal Father and of the creative prerogatives of the eternal Son. But as we observe the practical outworking of the Michael functions in the universes, we discern apparent differences. Some creator sons appear to be more like God the Father, others more like God the Son. For example, the trend of administration in the universe of Nevadon suggests that its creator and ruling son is one whose nature and character more resemble that of the eternal mother son. And they make that point. So there's your, it should be further stated that some universes are presided over paradise Michaels, who appear equally to resemble God the Father and God the Son. And these observations are in no sense implied criticisms. They are simply a recording of fact.
Because each one is different, to the point that Marvin was making. Yeah.
That makes your point, Marvin. That was the passage I was looking for.
Yeah,
that's very
what I suspected.
It's very specific, very specific.
I wanted to
go on to a whole separate point that went back to what you were saying, Andre, about the coordinate and the nature of sonship is coordinate. And I'll see if I can do this. It's a little subtle, but I think I can hold on to the point and express it. You've got the Father, right? And the Father creates beings solely. So the Father, for instance, created the eternal Mother Son individually. No other being participated in the creation of that eternal Mother Son. It was so a soul succession out of the Father. The Father also creates other beings, but also separates out of his own nature the pre-personal fragments of the adjusters. In other words, they are pure Father fragments, right? They're not, even though they're not actually created. They're basically divisions or fragmentations of the Father's original nature, somehow individual and yet somehow still associated with the Father. The sons of God are created by, in some fashion, always by the eternal Son or derivations of the eternal Son. They may be in cooperation with the Father. So we are considered of the orders of the sons of God. Human beings are the sons of God, and they consider us dual origin nature beings, right? Mm-hmm. Which means our destiny, who we are as beings, we are created beings. In other words, our personalities are given to us by the Father. In a certain fashion, our bodies and minds and much of the rest of our nature are derived from the Creator Son and the Mother Spirit working in harmony. But we are definitely created beings out of the order of Michael and the Creator's sons, and we are destined to merge with the pure Father fragment. So that's why I use it as a takeaway that we are dual origin beings. But the point that I wanted to get to is the Creator sons are midway between, in a sense, the Father and the Eternal Mother Son and human beings. And they come down and they complete that continuum by living as a mortal being as part of their experience. So they incorporate the Son experience, in a sense, from the top to the bottom, but they sit in the middle as where their permanent residence and nature is. We, as human beings, as sons of God, sit at the bottom of that created trajectory. We are the lowest form of Son ever created. There's no order of sonship that is created lower than us. We start at the very, very bottom, and we work our way up to paradise status, paradise nature. So we're trying to cover the same spectrum of sonship, working from the bottom all the way up to the top, and the Creator sons start in the middle, and they reach up to the Father on paradise, and they stretch down to the status of mortal beings in their incarnation plan. The interesting thing is that they say when we reach culmination in the seventh stage spirits at the end of the age of the Supreme, our experience will then, we will merge, our minds will merge in a certain sense with the mind of the Supreme, and we will partake of all finite experience at the end of the age, in joining with the Supreme. So in a sense, we fuse with the Father Adjuster, we are sons, and we merge with the mind of the Supreme, the experiential mind, and that basically sets us at the beginning, the cusp of this shift into the age of the ultimate, where in a certain sense we have joined with God at both ends of the spectrum, both God as original and God as finite, culminating in the Supreme. And so in a certain sense, we go forward through the age of the ultimate, and what they intimate is that we will eventually rejoin. We will not lose our individuality. We will never lose the history of having started at the very bottom of finite existence. Nothing can be lower. But we will have covered the entire gamut through the age of the Supreme, the age of the ultimate, and they intimate that we will somehow, in a sense, rejoin God as absolute in some future age. In some fashion, we will reconnect with God as absolute and, in a sense, complete the circle of eternity as created beings. And so, in a certain sense, as sons, we are coordinate. And along with Jesus, with Christ Michael, we will go forward with the Creator Sons and complete the trajectory of sonship to rejoin the original source, the creator source of the Father, in some mysterious way. That's what they intimate, is my sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, that's
wonderful.
Well, I'm
tired.
I need a nap.
That's quite a journey. Wow.
I know.
Beautiful.
I know. I mean,
thank you.
Really.
We just completed it all, and we haven't begun. Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of the miracle is that way down at the bottom. I mean, we are at the very bottom, right now, guys. There is no lower.
No
There's
doubt.
No lower status. And
the
it's
babies
astounding.
Of the universe.
Yeah, it's astounding that we, at the very bottom, can somehow conceive of the ultimate closure of that circle of eternity,
yes.
That God has created us with that capacity. That is absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah,
He's in us. It's because he's in us. And what you just described to me was Jesus saying, I am the bridge between time and eternity.
Yeah.
You know, a living bridge. He literally comes from our destiny and descends to our origin. And we begin at our origin and ascend to his to our destiny, which is his origin. He literally is the ultimate way shower of all time.
Yes, he is.
No wonder
he
will stay with us throughout eternity.
And we go through the sun.
We do. He's the bridge.
Like
through and through.
We cross over him.
In other words, no one comes to the Father except through the Son. That's offensive to a lot of people that don't believe in Jesus. But those that eventually get on the eternal track will go to Salvington, and they will go through Jesus on the way to the Father.
And they won't be offended anymore. They won't be offended
at that point.
Lately, I think of some of the people, the many that have gone over to the other side, right? And what comes to me over and over again is, but they know that now. They know that now.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't figure it out here, they will know it there. And there's no dire consequence for not figuring it out here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They know that now. And God bless them, and God bless us all, you know, for God, especially us who have been blessed to find this revelation and read it and give it a chance in our lives.
Well, sooner or later we realize that he does blaze the trail, as they say.
Yes.
The path.
Sooner or later. Yeah.
Exactly.
So he shows
and we won't be offended anymore.
Yeah. We're going through him. We are going through his reality. Yeah,
right.
By means of his reality.
We're also
by
going
means
with
of his
too.
Reality. He created our homeland here.
Yes. But I don't think we ever leave him behind, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, no. I agree.
Oh, no.
We don't leave him behind.
He's the way, you know. But we also, in some real sense, we also go with him. Like, we follow him.
Yes.
He says, follow me, however
exactly.
He said that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's the perfect segue into the spirit gravity circuit, don't you think?
Wait a second.
Oh, here we go. I knew Chuck was holding something.
Yeah, I've been holding out here. No, this is quick. I just wanted to point out something in what we, in that first section. The second sentence in the second paragraph, I think, is also very interesting, and I think it's worth just reflecting on for a second, where they say that the Son shares the Father's self-distributive nature in the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the infinite Spirit, their conjoint executive. So I was thinking about that. Well, what do they mean by the Father's self-distributive nature? And one example of that would be the thought adjusters. Obviously, that he literally fragments himself and distributes his presence in that way within each of us. So that's a really clear, I think, example of the Father's self-distributive nature. But then thinking about the Son with his unstinted bestowal of himself upon the infinite Spirit, and then thinking about all the ministry of the infinite Spirit, you know, the intelligence
all the angels, seraphim,
that we all that appreciate so much, realizing that is in some real sense, the sun distributing his nature.
Wow.
Through the angelic ministry of the infinite
well,
spirit.
And mm-hmm. wouldn't it also be the worlds? Wouldn't it also include the material aspect? The world on which the minister, Mother Third, is going to minister and mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, words, in mind and everything. I mean, everything that's the mm-hmm. infinite spirit. Of
right. But,
could
but
be
because
to be
he
part
is
of
a,
that.
Yes, because he's dual, he's both
yeah.
spirit, the sun is spirit and material. That is
right.
also being, mm-hmm. yeah, sent through.
Yeah.
Well, it also,
but I'm trying to kind of get to the personal aspect of it. You know,
I get it.
Yeah. I mean, just the idea
also,
that we can experience the Father through our thought adjuster, but we can experience, in a sense, the Son through angelic ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's
yeah.
part of how he distributes himself.
Yeah.
Because the Son doesn't fragment. The eternal Son doesn't fragment.
Right.
But the Father does. Well.
Anyway, that was all I wanted to throw in there.
I think there's also some insight available there in terms of our differential nature as men and women and as fathers and mothers.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain sense, mm-hmm. I sort of experience myself, this is the idea anyway, I experience myself as a father-son being. And I mm-hmm. think women would experience themselves as a mother-son being.
That's good.
So when they say that the son shares the father's self-distributive nature, I associate that more with women in how they relate to children than I do with men. It's almost mm-hmm. like the mothers give part of themselves. They distribute their own nature into their children. And mm-hmm. the fathers, not having that maternal function, are more like a fatherly variation of sonship. They're created beings, but they don't distribute themselves in the same way that mothers do. And that, to me, it's not a lack. It's just a specialization of nature.
Right.
And to me, that's a very rich differentiation to think about.
Mm.
You know, and the other thing that's sort of associated with that is mm-hmm. the way they use the adjectives creator and creative are mm-hmm. very intentional. I think they talk about the creator sons and the creative mother spirits. They never
uh-huh.
call the mother spirits the creator mother spirits, but always the creative. And so I think that's part wrapped up in the self-distributive nature of mothers. They in a mm. sense, give part of their nature to their children, and they distribute themselves in that sense. And so that feels very, very related to the mother-father qualities.
Well, that must be why every mother is so keen to hang her child's creative masterpiece on the fridge, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
That creativity. That was great. Well, I'm glad you added that, Chuck. That added a real nugget, a real gem right there to this
mm-hmm.
preamble that we just read. Do we want to go
yeah.
ahead and read the Spirit Gravity Circuit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, who would like to read that?
I just want to underscore what Marvin said, though, about the creative thing. You know, I mean, I think we can look to the mother as giving the sort of the spirit of creativity, whereas we look to the son as the sort of the function of actually creating, right? And
yeah.
those two complement each other and go together. I mean, and for anyone who's ever done art or music or anything creative, there's a spirit to creativity. And I
mm-hmm.
like to think of the mother kind of upholding that value level of, you know, kind of the spirit of creativity, the creative spirit, just put it in other words. Whereas the son actually, you know, we work by his side, you know, we labor with the son in actually creating things. You know, that's part of what we do as sons, is we have creator responsibility. You know, all the things we do in our lives, they're where we make new things happen that wouldn't happen otherwise. You know, even like doing this radio show, it's a creative project. So there's the spirit of creativity to that, but then there's also the act of creation that's involved as well. And the two complement each other in a kind of a, you know, beautiful way.
I love the spirit of creativity. It's the zeitgeist, right? That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Spirit
there
of the
is
times.
A spirit. Yes.
Spirit of the times, yes.
That's what we want to cultivate, you know, and capture people's
mm-hmm.
imaginations,
mm-hmm.
right? So that they start thinking about light and life and not darkness and death.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I see as one, you know, that one of our great challenges on this planet right now is to start cultivating that spirit of creativity about around enlightenment and light and life. But,
well, more to be revealed.
Well, no, it's like the question. It's kind of like
well,
today
I mean,
the question out there is, are we going to make it? And it seemed to me that if your answer isn't yes, then you won't.
Careful what you wish for.
Right? Does that make
yeah,
sense?
Yeah, careful what you wish for. And isn't that what Viktor Frankl said, too? The ones that survived were the ones that could imagine that they would.
Yeah.
And could
yeah.
envision
the
it.
The power, that's, we are creators. That's our creative nature. That is the sphere of gravity pull that we're going to talk about right now.
Yay. Well, Pam, do you want to read that section? It's a long
oh.
one. You can pass it off if you like. Or
Go for it.
I'll start.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, the spirit gravity circuit. Everything taught concerning the immanence of God, his omnipresence, omnipotence, and omniscience is equally true of the sun in the spiritual domain. The pure and universal spirit gravity of all creation, this exclusively spiritual circuit leads directly back to the person of the second source and center on paradise. He presides over the control and operation of that ever-present and unerring spiritual grasp of all true spirit values. Thus does the Eternal Son exercise absolute spiritual sovereignty. He literally holds all spirit realities and all spiritualized values, as it were, in the hollow of his hand. I love it.
Yeah.
The control of universal spiritual gravity is universal spiritual sovereignty. There's something to think about.
mm-hmm.
This gravity control of spiritual things operates independently of time and space. Therefore, is spirit energy undiminished in transmission? Spirit gravity never suffers time delays, nor does it undergo space diminution. It does
it's one
not
of those
decrease.
Words.
Yes. It does not decrease in accordance with the square of the distance of its transmission. The circuits of pure spirit power are not retarded by the mass of the material creation. And this transcendence of time and space by pure spirit energies is inherent in the absoluteness of the sun. It is not due to the interposition of the anti-gravity forces of the third source and center. Hmm. Spirit realities respond to the drawing power of the center of spiritual gravity in accordance with their qualitative value. Their actual degree of spirit nature, quality, is just as responsive to spirit gravity as the organized energy of physical matter, quantity, is responsive to physical gravity. Spiritual values and spirit forces are real. From the viewpoint of personality, spirit is the soul of creation. Matter is the shadowy physical body. The reactions and fluctuations of spirit gravity are ever true to the content of spiritual values. the qualitative spiritual status of an individual or world. This drawing power is instantly responsive to the inter and intra-spirit values of any universe situation or planetary condition. Every time a spiritual reality actualizes in the universes, this change necessitates the immediate and instantaneous readjustment of spirit gravity. Such a new spirit is actually a part of the second source and center, just as certainly as mortal man becomes a spiritized being. He will attain the spiritual sun, the center, and source of spirit gravity. I think I'll stop there.
Chuck, do you want to keep going? Do we want to finish reading it, and then we'll discuss it? There's a lot to discuss, but we can pick up next week, too.
Sure, I'd be happy to carry on. Come back to all of it.
Okay.
So let's see. We're picking up the sun's spiritual drawing power.
Yes, five.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Perfect. The sun's spiritual drawing power is inherent to a lesser degree in many paradise orders of sonship, for they do exist within the absolute spirit gravity circuit. Those local systems of spiritual attraction that function in the lesser units of creation. Spiritual attraction. Such sub-absolute focalizations of spirit gravity are a part of the divinity of the creator, personalities of time and space, and are correlated with the emerging experiential over-control of the Supreme Being. Such gravity pull and response thereto operate not only on the universe as a whole, but also even between individuals and groups of individuals. There's a spiritual cohesiveness among the spiritual and spiritized personalities of any world, race, nation, or believing group of individuals. There's a direct attractiveness of a spirit nature between spiritually minded persons of like tastes and longings. The term kindred spirits is not wholly a figure of speech. Like the material gravity of paradise, the spiritual gravity of the eternal sun is absolute. Sin and rebellion may interfere with the operation of local universe circuits, but nothing can suspend the spirit gravity of the eternal sun. The Lucifer Rebellion produced many changes in your system of inhabited worlds and on your rancho, but we do not observe that the resultant spiritual quarantine of your planet in the least affected the presence and function of either the omnipresent spirit of the eternal sun or the associated spirit gravity circuit. That's good to know. All reactions of the spirit gravity circuit of the grand universe are predictable. We recognize all actions and reactions of the omnipresent spirit of the eternal sun and find them to be dependable. In accordance with well-known laws, we can and do measure spiritual gravity just as man attempts to compute the workings of finite physical gravity. There is an unvarying response of the sun's spirit to all spirit things, beings, and persons. And this response is always in accordance with the degree of actuality, the qualitative degree of reality of all such spiritual values. But alongside this very dependable and predictable function of the spiritual presence of the eternal sun, are encountered phenomena which are not so predictable in their reactions. Such phenomena probably indicate the coordinate action of the deity absolute. Oh, I knew they were going to get in here somehow.
Yeah, here he comes. That wizard.
That's the wild card. Such phenomena probably indicate the coordinate action of the deity absolute in the realms of emerging spiritual potentials. Spiritual potentials.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the spirit presence of the Eternal Son is the influence of a majestic and infinite personality, but we hardly regard the reactions associated with the conjectured performances of the Deity Absolute as personal.
Mm.
Let's come back to that.
Yeah.
Viewed from the personality standpoint and by persons, to include us, the Eternal Son and the Deity Absolute appear to be related in the following way. Eternal Son dominates the realm of actual spiritual values, whereas the Deity Absolute seems to pervade the vast domain of potential spirit values. All actual value of spirit nature finds lodgment in the gravity grasp of the Eternal Son, but if potential, then apparently in the presence of the Deity Absolute. Spirit seems to emerge from the potentials of the Deity Absolute. Evolving spirit finds correlation in the experiential and incomplete grasp of the Supreme and the Ultimate. Spirit eventually finds final destiny in the absolute grasp of the spiritual gravity of the Eternal Son. This appears to be the cycle of experiential spirit, but existential spirit is inherent in the infinity of the second source and center. Cycle of experiential spirit.
Yeah.
That's like spirit coming into actuality. In time,
so spirit obviously is evolving, don't you? It would that be how you interpret that? Spirit
evolving or emerging.
As values expand.
Right.
Mm.
And evolve, huh?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, there's something that caught me. There's so much in here. I gotta say.
Yeah.
You know, I can very easily relate to material realities, you know, my body, the world,
sure. The
chair I sit in. I can pretty easily react and understand and grasp mindal realities, ideas, concepts, etc. The realm of spiritual realities has been harder for me to get my arms around. And for me, I always associate spiritual realities with persons. And what personalities, and when Jesus said that I will draw all people up to me, if I'm lifted up, I will draw. What I think he's speaking of is the spirit gravity of the Creator Son. It's an actual drawing
yes.
power.
And I agree.
When people were around Jesus, they were drawn to him. He was like, he had a spiritual drawing power. His person and the way he lived was attractive.
Right.
And
beauty is attractive.
That speaks to me. And there's two related passages that relate to that quality of reality that is attractive. One is, and this is what I was caught by, one is in 7:1-8, which we just read. And it's the last paragraph in that, last sentence of that paragraph. They say, there is an unvarying response to the Son's, of the Son's spirit to all spirit things, beings, and persons. And this response is always in accordance with a degree of actuality, the qualitative degree of reality of all such spiritual values. So what caught me was that phrase, the qualitative degree of reality, and it made me think of another section, which is in the Seven Psychic Circles, and it begins at 110.6.7, And it says the conquest, at the end of that paragraph, says the conquest of these levels of cosmic evolution, meaning the psychic circles, is reflected in three ways. The first two are adjuster attunement and soul evolution. But the third criterion for the conquest of psychic circles is what they call personality reality. They say the degree of selfhood reality is directly determined conquest. Persons become more real as they ascend from the seventh to the first level of mortal existence. And so what it's saying to me is that as a human being branches out and becomes more mature and becomes more spiritually, more impregnated with spiritual values, they live truth, beauty, goodness, and love more fully in their lives.
They embody that.
They embody. I've always thought when they say that the sons, the Creator sons, are the Word of God, or that the Eternal Son is the Word of God, the Word I've always thought that is always associated with the concept of being the Word or the expression is the word embodiment. That they are in the embodiment of the personality of the Father. The Father is not embodied. The Eternal Son is embodies the personality, and that we in turn embody the spiritual values we put into, we make them come alive, make them become real. So this concept of spiritual qualities related to becoming more real spiritually and having a drawing power is that I can relate to. It's very evocative. You know, Jesus,
so true.
The reason Jesus is so attractive is because he is so real, and there was so much to him spiritually that we're drawn to it, you know, of spiritual value.
And
so
the real in us is attracted to the real in him. And
exactly.
The more real, the more spiritual we become, the more effective his drawing power is. If I'm understanding this section, or at least parts of it correctly, they're telling us that the more spiritual we become, the more potent is spirit gravity on us, and the more effectively can it draw us upward and inward toward the center of all things.
It has.
And that's to our benefit.
it has a physical parallel, Paula. It's exactly right. It's like the larger a planet is, the more gravity it has associated with it, and the more it is drawn to another body. In the same sense, the more we have spiritual mass in our personalities, the more real and the larger, in a sense, we become. And Jesus is so attractive to us because his presence was massive. His spiritual presence was huge. Whenever we come into his orbit, we're drawn to him because of how spiritually massive he is, how real he is.
And especially if we're in that vein of, you know, and before you go, Chuck, I just want to point out this, the paragraph 3 really is intriguing because it kind of touches on these things. It says, spirit realities respond to the drawing power of the center of spiritual gravity in accordance with their qualitative value, their actual degree of spirit nature, spirit substance, quality. I love it when they give us these definitions. Little definitions are kind of put throughout the book here. Spirit substance, quality, is just as responsive to spirit gravity as the organized energy of physical matter, quantity, is responsive to physical gravity. Spiritual values and spirit forces are real. From the viewpoint of personality, spirit is the soul of creation. Matter is the shadowy physical body. That is such an amazing paragraph, isn't it?
That's hefty.
I mean,
yeah.
It just spells it out. And this idea that spirit substance is quality and material substance is matter, is quantity.
Mm-hmm. So I like how they...
Intriguing. Mm-hmm. So intriguing to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I so like beautiful. How they bring this concept down to our level in paragraph 6, where they say that spirit gravity pull and response, spirit gravity pull and response thereto operate not only on the universe as a whole, but also even between individuals and groups
yes.
of individuals.
Mm, I
yes.
love that.
There's
yes.
a spiritual cohesiveness among the spiritual and spiritized personalities of any world, nation, or believing group of individuals. There's a direct attractiveness of a spirit nature between spiritually minded persons of like tastes and longings. The term kindred spirits is not wholly a figure of speech, but this grab, this attraction, this gravitational attraction of spirit, you know, Jesus is our sort of master pattern, you might say, or the master, really, in human form where this is concerned. I mean, we really, really, so vivid with him, his appeal, his attractiveness.
Yes.
But they're saying that this also operates just between all of us, potentially. You know, we can feel this with each other also, which I think
don't we experience
yes.
that every time
yes.
we go to a conference together and we are just like
oh,
a
yeah.
magnet. We're just drawn to each
yeah.
other.
Well, and
so
I think
amazing.
I think we experience it here in Cosmic Citizen. I mean,
oh, yeah.
you know, we've talked about this before. There's an energy that comes from our association because we're allowing these spiritual realities to flow between us and draw us together. And it's actually kind of thrilling, you know,
it is
tremendously energizing.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I hope so.
I know
you guys have all experienced this. I've experienced
yeah.
this with other people as well. You know,
sure.
where
absolutely.
With certain
oh, yeah.
people and in certain teams of people and groups of people who are working together on projects, there is a clear sense of spiritual energy that moves
oh, yeah.
through us and among us that is very empowering. I don't know how else to say it. It allows
yeah,
us
here's
to get. It allows us to get stuff done in the spiritual
yeah.
realm. Yeah.
And it is a quality.
Yeah,
it's a quality yeah. that we're drawing out, that we're recognizing
exactly.
the quality.
Quality,
of each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go
on,
ahead,
paper 16. Yeah, paper 16, 6-3 says, the fact of the cosmic mind explains the kinship of various types of human and superhuman minds. Not only are kindred spirits attracted to each other, but kindred minds are also very fraternal and inclined toward cooperation, the one with the other. Human minds are sometimes observed to be running in channels of astonishing similarity and inexplicable agreement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that quote. That's
isn't
a
that
great
fun?
One. Yeah,
yeah,
it is.
Well, this idea of cohesiveness, I think, is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you just
yeah.
read is kind of describing that in other words. But they say there's a spiritual cohesiveness among spiritual and spiritized personalities. So I looked up cohesiveness, of course. One of the definitions is the quality of sticking together.
True. It's beautiful.
And, you know, I think we experience that. I mean, we
oh,
just have a natural desire
oh, yeah.
to hang out with others who know God.
Yeah.
You know, because you can see it transforming them in real time.
Yeah.
Same with ourselves.
You know, one thing I like to point out when I introduce the book to people, and it's something that most people wouldn't think about, but and I put it out there for you guys because we share this. We read this book and we sought each other out. we had to literally reach out in some way.
Yeah.
And most of us, at least in our generation, wrote to the publisher to find out who else reads it. And I like to pose that question for groups that I introduce the book to. I like to say, so how many books on your shelf at home did you write to the publisher to see who else reads it? And
oh.
they always look at me like, huh, yeah, not any, actually. Not any book did I do that, you know. But we did. We wrote to the publisher and said, you know, I remember my letter. I can't be the only one on the planet that's believing this. In fact, I know there must be others, and I have to find them. So
you know,
that
Paula,
gravity,
that's really,
that spirit.
That's really funny. You know, the Rancher Foundation is the only publisher I have ever tried to contact for that purpose. But you're right.
Isn't that interesting?
That's really interesting. Huh?
That spirit gravity at work. We were passive about it. We were active about it. I got to find these others. I am going to find them. You know,
mm-hmm.
I am going to do it.
Well, you know, yeah. the other thought that's associated with this is that this spirit tendency to draw together this the power of that gravity and that energy, a qualitative gravity and energy, will only get stronger when we move outside of this life into the early stages of the Rancher life. Because the material nature that sort of clouds that and enshrouds it will be removed, mm-hmm. and we'll have physical bodies and minds of a Marantia substance that will be much more spirit responsive and recognizing. And that's so exciting to anticipate, you know.
Mm-hmm. It'll only get better, right? It's like the book kind of promises us. There's only up from here. It only gets better. This is as close to hell as we'll ever get, you know? And it's only better as it gets better and better. And that's a promise. We can take it to the bank, you know? We can take it for granted.
The spirit bank.
Yeah, if we do our part to develop those values, those qualities of spirit within ourselves, the gravity spirit will take us there. It's just going to happen. And, you know, this was a great show, you guys. I loved it so much. Thank you so much. And I want to end with a paragraph that I think you guys will all recognize and absolutely love. And this kind of ties the idea of the Trinity together, and the worship that beings like us, once we get to paradise, the worship we feel, the love we feel for these magnificent deities that are our creators. And this is from paper 27. Which is the ministry of the primary supernifum. They throw gems in throughout the book, right? Where you just never know where they're going to show up. They're it's obviously throughout the whole thing, but 2777. Sometimes all paradise becomes engulfed in a dominating tide of spiritual and worshipful expression. Often the conductors of worship cannot control such phenomena until the appearance of the threefold fluctuation of the light of the deity abode, signifying that the divine heart of the gods has been fully and completely satisfied by the sincere worship of the residents of paradise, the perfect citizens of glory and the ascendant creatures of time. What a triumph of technique. What a fruition of the eternal plan and the purposes of the gods that the intelligent love of the creature child should give such full satisfaction to the infinite love of the Creator Father. What a great one.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
It is so beautiful and so inspiring.
Through the tumultuous times that we're in.
Creative.
We've got that to look forward to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Behind us.
What a triumph of technique. I love that. That's just, yeah. That's,
man, we have so much to look forward to.
Yeah. We sure do. Through all of this tumult, let's just hold the promise. These promises of eternity. It's so worth holding now.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh.
What a great chapter.
Well, thank you, everyone.
Hope we get to enjoy more of the same section next week. I think there's more to unpack there.
Oh, boy, there is. That's true.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
We'll revisit. Yeah.
All right. It's been wonderful.
All right, my friends. So next week it's the administration of the Eternal Son, and we'll unpack this section we just read two more. So hope you guys can make it. We appreciate you a lot. I appreciate all of you.
Such a
pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, friends.
Thank you.
Well, until next time, bye for now. Love you guys.
All right.
Love you, too.
Have a great week.
Lots of love. Lots
you too. Happy
love.
Veterans Day. Happy Diwali.
Yep.
Love you guys.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Don't forget about that. Okay.
All right.
Darkness away.
Bye for now.
For coming.
Bye
darkness
for now.
Love you.
Bye-bye.
Love you too.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.